time, 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
The Thursday Morning Show on WGTV. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really glad that we can begin today's morning show with a conversation about COVID-19 and this ongoing pandemic that is very much still with us. And I'm speaking today on the morning show with someone who is a colleague of Carlo Nevacossi, who has joined us quite a number of times. This time around, he is referring me to the deputy director of the Walworth County Department of Health and Human Services, Trista Piccola. And she is going to be giving us an update on how things are looking in Walworth County right now, kind of an exciting development that begins next week in terms of younger people receiving the vaccination. We'll talk about boosters, who should be getting them, and much, much more. Trista Piccola, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me and for this continuing timely topic of COVID.
Right. It's something we all want to be done with. To varying degrees, we all want that. But of course, the reality is that it's still very much a part of all of our lives, whether we want it to be or not. One of the first things I wanted to be sure to ask you is, and maybe at this point in time, it is premature to even know, but as was the case with Thanksgiving 2020, for Thanksgiving 2021, there were plenty of concerns that as people gather, that there would be the possibility of some kind of surge in COVID numbers. Is it too soon for us to have any idea at this point? We're recording this on the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. At this point, do we have any way of knowing if there was any sort of COVID effect from Thanksgiving?
It's just a little soon. So there is an incubation period for COVID of several days. And so we'll know probably early next week if there is going to be any type of surge in cases. We have seen a bit of an uptick in cases in the last couple of weeks. Not any different really from any other areas in the region itself. The county has still not come out of a state of high transmission for COVID just yet. So we're waiting to see, but the cases, again, we've seen a small uptick and we're watching that very, very closely. And so sometime early next week, we'll know if there's gonna be any sort of additional surge, as you said, related to gatherings over the Thanksgiving holiday.
Right. So when people go to the Walworth County Department of Health and Human Services website, they can find very easily something that is, I think, known as your COVID-19 dashboard, in which quite a lot of information is available. So, for instance, when we go to that and we see total probable cases, and that's as of today, November 30th, 4,638. Can you explain exactly what that number means when you say 4,638 total probable cases?
So there are probable cases and there are confirmed cases. So probable cases are people who evidence symptoms of COVID. And then there are confirmed cases that happen through testing. So it's important to pay attention to both, because not everyone is necessarily testing positive for COVID, but still evidences COVID symptoms. So we watch both of those numbers closely. The other thing, sort of separate but very related, is we're also into flu season. And so we're watching all respiratory diseases very, very closely because of the interaction that we could potentially have that could put further strains on the care system. So we watch both of those closely. Again, we've seen, as I said earlier, we've seen a small uptick in cases. What we watch most closely when we're talking about how we characterize transmission rates is something called a seven-day rolling number. And so transmission rates are calculated in an additive kind of way. So we watch new cases over a seven-day period to try to determine if we're seeing an uptick. So again, we watch probable and confirmed, so we know how much illness in total is out there. And then we watch the seven-day rolling number to determine whether or not we're seeing an uptick in cases.
One of the things I find most striking on your dashboard is when we have, I think you call them bar graphs, and there are bar graphs that show over the span of the pandemic, first of all, the rate of hospitalizations and also the death rate. And what I did not sort of realize is that for as serious as the current situation is, 1 year ago, that was when things, it appears, were at its worst in terms of hospitalization and the number of people dying. It's kind of staggering to see that depicted on a graph in such stark fashion. And it's not to make us complacent about the current situation, but it's probably good for us to remember how incredibly serious the situation was a year ago.
I'm really glad you picked up on that. You know, I was looking at that data myself the other day, and what you noted about deaths in particular and where we are, just where we were just a year ago, in December of 2020 alone, we had 56 confirmed COVID deaths. And it's primarily within our most vulnerable. And remember, we didn't have vaccine on hand at that point. And so most of those folks were people over the age of 65 and who had some comorbidities going on, but that was substantial, just in December alone. And so while we are much better positioned because vaccines have been on the scene now for a number of months, we can't let up on our strategies for testing and for getting as much vaccine out as people are willing to accept, so that we can, at some point, we hope, sort of round the corner, turn the corner more fully on the pandemic.
Right. One thing that is shared widely statistically is the notion that being vaccinated is by far the best protection one can have against COVID. That being said, there are a small number of people who are even fully vaccinated who nevertheless do contract the COVID and occasionally even become seriously ill from it. But again, the likelihood of that is greatly diminished when one is fully vaccinated. Are you, as the Department of Health and Human Services, able to track that in terms of, for instance, the 11 current hospitalizations in Walworth County? Are you in a position to know and track how many of those are people who are vaccinated versus unvaccinated?
We are. I couldn't tell you of the 11 most recent admissions without going back and looking at the data. But the last time we looked at breakthrough, what we call breakthrough cases, it was really less than 1% of all new COVID cases. And to your point, which was well made, it's the likelihood of those being very serious cases are few and far between. And for the few that are breakthrough cases where people do get seriously ill, they usually have something else going on, some other serious health condition going on that is exacerbating that.
What would we see if we viewed a map of Walworth County in terms of the so-called hotspots? Are there particular communities or particular areas of Walworth County in which the outbreaks of COVID cases are especially high? Or is it more generally distributed throughout the county, of course, allowing for variation in population density, of course. But aside from that, are there hot spots about which you are especially concerned?
No, I think the places where we're paying most attention to preventing outbreaks are still in long-term care facilities and in schools. And we have to really give a lot of credit to both of those areas, both long-term care staff and school staff, for doing really great mitigation strategies. It's not that there haven't been any outbreaks, there certainly have, but they've really done a great job paying attention to putting all the precautions they possibly can in place. So those are the places, again, because you have people who are congregated together, that we pay the closest attention to and monitor most closely. So, but you hit on population density. Obviously, you know, when you have more people in close proximity to one another, there is an increased likelihood of an outbreak having happened. But back to your point about vaccination, we want to continue to encourage everyone who is able to and willing to get a vaccine to get a vaccine. Vaccine is readily available. It's available here at our county's public health department. It's available still in pharmacies and 10 or 11 other spots throughout the county. So you should be able to get a vaccine in any community here. If for some reason you can't find or get access to a vaccine, please give us a call and we'll help you figure it out.
Also on your dashboard is information on the percentage of Walworth County residents who have been vaccinated, and it is gratifying to see that number quite a bit higher than the first time I spoke with your colleague, Carlo Nevacosi. Can you give us some sense of how those numbers have increased over the last few months, and in a sense, how far we still have to go to get those numbers to where you would really like to see them in terms of percentage of people vaccinated?
Sure. Yeah. So we have nowhere to go but up, which is good. We're not where we would like to be. We're a bit lower than we would like to be. But again, I think we were prepared to experience a little more vaccine hesitancy compared to maybe some other areas of the state or even in this region. So the best thing that we can do is continue to educate people about the safety of the vaccines, continue to advertise and market where vaccine is available. We think as the months have gone on, and as we've watched the data, we've certainly seen more people getting vaccinated. And now as boosters have arrived on the scene, and at this point, every adult is recommended to go ahead and get their booster shot. We're encouraging that as well. So again, we're not exactly where we would like to be, but we want to make sure people are educated and aware about the safety of the vaccines. It is certainly a personal decision to get vaccinated. So we just want to continue to encourage people to call us if they have any questions at all about vaccine.
Right. I know from talking to Carlo Nevacosi and your colleague with the Department of Health and Human Services that one of the efforts made by Walworth County was to, in a sense, take the vaccine to the people. Make it as convenient as possible. And it sounds like some of those efforts have paid off.
Yes, we have. And in fact, in June of this year, we bought a mobile health hub. So we really took our immunization and vaccine services out on the road, as well as some of our other health and human services, access to some of our other programs here. But primarily, it's been getting the vaccine out. So we've been able to take that health hub out to various schools in the community throughout the summer to educate and provide access To vaccine for students, for teachers and faculty, and to parents as well. We were at the fairgrounds over the course of 3 days offering vaccine. We were at the farmers markets throughout the summer offering vaccine. So again, we're trying to make it as easy as possible and as accessible as possible for people to get a vaccine if that's what they want to do.
Right. And I'm looking at your dashboard. Again, we're recording this interview on Tuesday the 30th, and we see the percentage of the Walworth County population partially vaccinated at just over 50%, and fully vaccinated at 44%. And are those statistics, is that for anybody of any age in Walworth County, or is that just the percentage of adults living in Walworth County?
Well, it's, and again, it depends on the data that you look at, because the data points will look different if you're looking at the adult population only, which is 18 and older, or at the 12 and older population. So I like to also use the CDC's website because they also have a vaccine tracker on there. And when you look at the population age 12 and older that are fully vaccinated, if you include them in the group, we're just at over 56%.
Wow.
And so as we look at our dashboard and plan to do some updating to our dashboard so that we're sharing with people, again, as we add the 5 to 11 group, for example, we want to make sure that all that information about how many people are actually getting the vaccination, how many people are actually reading, gets published.
Very good. You were telling me before we went on the air that this interview is well timed because of an announcement that you would like to make about something that goes into effect beginning next week. And this is related to vaccination. Tell our listeners about that.
Sure. So earlier in the month, people probably saw it in the news that kids age 5 to 11 were approved for vaccination, the Pfizer vaccine. And so it's been available through some pharmacies. So some kids have been able to get it there, some of their healthcare providers. But starting Monday, we will have a series throughout the month of December of pediatric specific clinics. All of those clinics, there's a calendar on our website. There are 9 of them between now and the end of the year at various times and at other here at Walworth County Health and Human Services, but also at some other places in the community. So for parents who wish to have their 5 to 11 year old vaccinated, those specialized clinics will be set up and accessible. And again, if anyone has any questions, feel free to give us a call. We are encouraging people for the pediatric clinics to make an appointment, but if somehow they're not able to, we know it's the busy holiday season, you may not be able to get around to making an appointment, then we're taking walk-ins as well. We're also doing other vaccinations during those times for adults who need a first dose or second dose vaccination or need their booster as well. So just check the website. All the information is detailed on the calendar as to when those clinics are happening, but we're very excited to be able to offer that now.
Great. Two more quick questions, if I may. We're speaking with Trista Piccola, who is the Deputy Director of the Walworth County Department of Health and Human Services. And we're talking, of course, about the COVID-19 pandemic. When you are looking at Walworth County and some of these statistics, either regarding COVID cases and or vaccination, do you fold into that the large population that comprises the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, which of course is within Walworth County? Is that a statistic that is sort of discrete from the rest, or are they counted just like anybody else in Walworth County? And adjacent to that question, how has the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater been doing in relationship to COVID?
So we try to keep the university stats and the larger community stats a bit discrete because that helps us better understand from a community level how we're doing in terms of testing, vaccination, community spread, anything like that. What I would tell you about the university is they've done extraordinarily well. So they still are operating a testing site there that is available to students, faculty. They also have a community testing site that's available Monday through Friday, all day long, which is terrific. It's a great access point being right there in Whitewater, because there's a large community up there that needs access to both testing and other COVID-related information. And so their faculty and student population, and apologies because I don't have the stats off the top of my head, but getting well into 70 and 80% vaccination rate. So they've done an amazing job. They got the word out. They educated their faculty. They educated their students. And we're so proud that they did such a great job. And they continue to do a great job with managing COVID-related issues. And so we're proud to be in good partnership with them. And they've been a huge support to us and a huge support to the community.
Excellent. That's so good to hear. Lastly, I almost hate to say the word Omicron, but of course, we are hearing a lot about the Omicron variation.
Yeah.
President Biden said this is cause for concern, but not for panic, although the stock market seemed to feel differently last Friday, for sure. But of course, it is very, very early, and my understanding is that there are no identified cases of the Omicron variant in the United States at all, let alone in Walworth County. Nevertheless, what do we as citizens need to know about the Omicron variant, and what effect should that have on all of us in terms of the measures that we take, such as vaccination, physical distancing, and so on?
Sure. So we're learning more about the Omicron variant, and as you said, it's not reached us yet. It has shown up in 14 other countries, so it's something that we need to be on guard about. They're learning more and putting more information out about the ability of the vaccine to be able to tackle this new variant, as it tackled the Delta variant in a very effective kind of way. And so without getting too deep in the weeds about how the vaccines actually work as an mRNA and all of these different terminologies that even I struggle with at different points in time. But anyway, it's something that we have to stay on guard about. And again, you said it earlier, which is the best defense that we have at this point is vaccination. And so, but Omicron is out there, and it will likely make its way here, as the other variants have. So we need to continue to practice all the mitigation strategies that we can. And one of the things I want to remind people of too is we're into flu season as well. So don't forget about the flu. Go get your flu shot. It's not too late to get your flu shot to really fully protect yourself and to try to stay well, you know, throughout December and into January and really into February and March as well.
Trista Piccola is the Deputy Director of the Walworth County Department of Health and Human Services. I so appreciate you taking time out of what I know is a busy schedule to share this information with us. And we, of course, invite people who are interested to visit your COVID-19 dashboard on the Health Department's website, which can be easily found through a Google search. And the information is laid out there very clearly and succinctly. Trista Piccola, thank you again for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We explore today the fascinating and sometimes very challenging world of phobias, and specifically what occurs when someone is assailed with very serious phobias which affect nearly every detail of their daily lives. I'm speaking today with Alan Shawn, who is already a well-known writer. You perhaps have seen his work in Atlantic Monthly. He's written an interesting book about composer Alan Schoenberg, and his newest book is called Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life, in which he talks about the array of phobias which have affected his life for many years, including especially serious agoraphobia and claustrophobia and so on. And he traces
some of the possible reasons why his life is one that is lived with the harsh realities of all these phobias and the ways in which he has managed to cope with them and carve out for himself a very successful and happy life. And we speak with him for the next few minutes about all of this. Again, the book called Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. And Alan Shaun, we welcome you to the morning show.
Very nice to talk with you, Greg.
Looking forward to this very, very much. So you are afraid of many different things, and when we sort of make a list of them, it's really kind of astonishing to realize how much of a full life you've been able to live, despite the fact that you have a terrible fear of heights and water and enclosed spaces and crowds and so on. In a nutshell, how have you managed to do that?
Well, I should say, first of all, that when I talk to other people with these types of problems, they generally unpack a pretty full suitcase of things that they don't like, just as I do. And it turns out that an awful lot of people suffer from not just a couple of specific things that they don't like, but kind of a whole constellation of things that circumscribes their behavior. But yes, like many people, I have tried to carve out a life that consists of the things that I don't need to avoid and that I don't dread. I teach. I'm a composer first and foremost, a pianist. I teach at Bennington College. I teach music. And I also have started to write in my midlife. I started to actually write. I first wrote the book on Arnold Schoenberg, and now I've written this book about really a subject that I wish I could avoid, but which turned out to be so fascinating that I did end up with quite a bit to say about it, as you know.
Right. When you are experiencing... I don't know if we want to call it an attack or what,
sure.
An attack of agoraphobia or one of these other phobias. For instance, you have great difficulty, for instance, if you have to drive over a bridge or in a tunnel.
Yes.
You cannot ride on a subway.
Right.
When you have these attacks, is there something tangible that you are afraid will happen to you? Or is it more of a kind of an unnamed and an unspecific sort of dread which you experience?
Well, people tend to think of these types of reactions as being all in your mind. But to the poor sufferer, it's much more like an allergy. You find that every time you go through a tunnel, you have a whole series of physical symptoms culminating in a lot of thoughts of dread, but it doesn't start by, you know, in a rational way with a thought such as the tunnel's going to cave in on me. It's really much more like a response that you'd see in a cat or a dog or a horse. You want to run, you want to flee. It's the famous fight or flight symptom.
Mm. Well, and you, I know, talk in the book about some of the very real physical symptoms.
Yes.
Which you experience as well. Tell our listeners about the most acute of them.
Well, I think our listeners all know these symptoms, but maybe most people experience them when there's really some danger occurring and they need to respond to it. Rapid heartbeat, shortness of breath, maybe a tightening in the chest or even chest pains, perspiring, tingling sensations, to name just a few, and then of course the mental experience of being confused and disoriented and kind of frantic, all of which is really physiological in origin. Although when it's happening to you, you ascribe it to, well, really one of two things. You think that you're physically in great danger or mentally in great danger.
Hmm.
In fact, what's happening is that your body is responding exactly as it should in a dangerous situation, but at the wrong time.
Mm. I think it's especially interesting that you have a terror for closed-in places,
yes,
and a fear of wide-open spaces, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the wide-open spaces reaction is something that only really I noticed when I started to write the book. A lot of these things are so instinctive that I just think of them as part of the world itself, part of life. And I realized, you know, even writing the book, how all of this added up into one giant syndrome that's really a very, very inconvenient, to put it mildly.
Hmm. Part of your book is an effort for you to maybe untangle some of the possible reasons behind your phobias, and specifically some of the ways in which your challenging childhood in a child challenging home might have at least something to do with why you live with these serious phobias. Yes. I want you to tell our listeners about the interesting story you tell of your mother and what she would be like in the car when your family would be going someplace. This is a really interesting insight into her and maybe into some of her demons.
Well, that's interesting that you focus on her, because, of course, in my childhood, my father was much more the person who we all thought of as suffering from anxiety and phobias. But our mother was very much a part of that, because she lived exactly the same way he did, but in a way her problems were concealed behind his, which were more obvious. And after his death, she didn't really live particularly differently. And she too had, an incredible fear of being in an unknown place and not knowing where she was, being lost. And when we would travel to Boston or sometimes through New Jersey, she would always have a map, and she would always be looking at every point along the way. But even going to Lincoln Center from 96th Street and 5th Avenue, she would tell the taxi driver exactly what route to take, where to turn, and she wouldn't dole it. She would dole it out rather slowly, bit by bit.
And politely, you tell us.
Very politely. Both my parents were amazingly courteous and gentle people, but there was a firm grip there, even on a small journey, as if there were all kinds of dangers out there that you had to be wary of.
Sure. So she would say, the driver would take a certain turn, as she requested, thank you. Now,
yes,
at the next corner, you will turn right. Thank you, and then on to the next.
Absolutely correct.
Hmm. And, of course, what I suppose might be at the heart of some of your life of fear, if we should call it that, is that if you saw in her this overwhelming need and desire for utter control, then stepping into any kind of situation which is clearly just beyond your control would be a truly frightening thing.
Yes. I mean, we're talking about how basic, you know, instincts can be molded by your upbringing and by your own habits. I mean, of course, we start with our genetic makeup, and I'm sure that in my family tree there's a strong genetic tendency towards anxiety. But then, you know, how you're brought up is terribly important, and you're completely right that having both parents who were monitoring their every move so carefully and not terribly spontaneous in the outer world, you know, they were quite spontaneous and adventurous intellectually, but in the outer world not. Of course, a lot of that rubbed off on me. But then, you know, you can move beyond your upbringing in so many ways. So the mystery is, you know, why one member of a family becomes very much like his parents, you know, in terms of problems such as, let's say, drinking or you know, anger or other kinds of difficulties people have, and another family member is free of them.
Hmm. It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is.
I wonder, in this life filled with so many phobias, is there a strong temptation for you to confront those things so feared in the hopes that maybe something has happened and maybe you're not going to be afraid of riding the subway, or you're not going to be afraid to go over a bridge or through a tunnel? Or at some point, do you know without even attempting to encounter those things that such a thing remains impossible? And is it possible to really know that?
Right. That's a difficult question. You'd hope that such things might just evaporate on their own. I think the only way to get over these types of habits of body and mind, really, is to have positive experiences doing those things, and to demystify them and retrain, really, your very brain to respond differently to those experiences. So there's, yes, I mean, I've never stopped pushing myself, although, you know, everybody who knows me wishes I pushed myself more. But, of course, I keep trying all kinds of things in an effort not to discover that I no longer have the responses, because they're so ingrained, but to bit by bit chip away at the habits. I'm really talking about habits that are ingrained in, you know, in the brain itself, to create new pathways in the brain, which sounds, you know, fanciful, except that's exactly what really the experts in the field recommend.
Hmm. You are, as you mentioned, a music faculty member. I should have certainly mentioned that. I happen to be a music professor myself.
No kidding.
Yeah, right. And you are a composer.
Yes.
And of course, one of the things that I'm sure has been especially painful or frustrating for you is the fact that it is tremendously difficult for you to be, for instance, at public concerts, even those where your own music is being performed. And
yeah,
it's hard to think of a more unfortunate scenario than someone who produces, creates music for just such occasions which either you cannot attend yourself or can only do so with sort of gritted teeth and grim determination. Has that become any easier over the years?
Well, I have, you know, ways of turning up at places that are, you know, highly enjoyable, and then there are situations that I simply can't bear. I mean, if I'm, you know, if I had a piece played at Lincoln Center and I could sit on the aisle, there's no problem with that for me. I have a joyful experience at such occasions. But if I have to take a plane or if I have to take an elevator to, you know, to even the 10th floor, the very same experience would be very difficult for me. And even driving, as you suggested earlier, you know, a few hours to a place I haven't been before to hear my own music, I would have to practice the drive as if, you know, as if there's something really difficult for me in the drive itself, and in finding my way there, which is, even to me, astonishing, but it's the truth.
Hmm. I don't have the book in front of me, unfortunately, and I'm trying to remember this for certain. I believe you are or have been married.
Oh, yes.
And have a family. That part, for some reason, was a little bit vague in my mind. And
right, because I don't really bring my personal life into the book much. I, you know, deliberately avoid.
Right. I mean, you talk about how in a sense, you wanted this to be both a personal and impersonal book.
Yes.
And I thought it was for a very laudable reason, because in a sense, you don't want people so caught up in some of the specific personal details of your own life that they can't sort of see themselves or use the book to help themselves with their own lives and their own particular situations.
Right. That's absolutely right. I mean, I was married for many years, and I was divorced, and I'm now remarried. I have two children, and I'm actually, believe it or not, expecting a third child in July, even though I'm about to turn 60.
Wow.
So, you know, my life is very eventful on the family plane.
Right.
I didn't want the book to be a memoir in the traditional sense. It's about 50% memoir. But I thought there were, because some of the members of my family are quite well known, I thought that it could easily be perceived as basically a book even of gossip. And I wanted it to be about personality and the origins of the many quirks we all have. Mine are, you know, really regrettable and pretty serious, but I think everybody has a personality and has sides of themselves that are mystifying to them. I would almost say that 99% of what we do as we go through our day is mystifying to us.
Hmm.
And I was trying to go deeper into that rather than to just talk about people who are well known. So actually, people reading the book don't even notice that I do not use names in my book for the most part, except for my sister. She has a name, and that was for a very specific reason.
This is a sister who is institutionalized?
She is. She's autistic and mentally retarded and suffers from schizoaffective disorder. And she is my twin. And the story of my sister sort of surfaces in the book as really equal in importance to my own story. And a big part of maybe the pain and difficulty behind my current problems. And to be honest, talking about mystification, that surprised me. As I was writing the book, I found that emerged. And
Your deep feelings about her and her
yes.
being institutionalized, and yes. that occurred at the age of 8.
Yes.
So this is a sad circumstance with which you have lived for many, many years.
For many years, and of course, certainly highlights the issue of traveling in a very different way than one might at first expect.
Hmm. We have just passed the 20-minute mark, but if you would permit me,
yes.
I would love to just have a brief word from you, if you have the time, to just tell us, if you are comfortable, just a little bit about what it has been like to create your own family within the framework of a life that is riddled with these phobias. I guess what I'm curious about more than anything is if you have managed to do that more easily than maybe you would have anticipated at the outset. I mean, what has that experience been like for you?
Well, I've tried to be more honest with my children than my parents were with me about these things. It's a different time, and there's a lot of candor in the air these days that was not there in the 1950s when I was growing up. So I've tried to be honest with them about the difficulties I have, and I've, you know, encouraged them to be adventurous in many ways that I have not been, and to try to take from me whatever my good points are. Also, my two children, who are now fairly grown up, 19 and 23, you know, their mother is a world traveler and completely different type of personality, so that's benefited them wonderfully. I mean, being a parent is participating in life, you know, and in evolution, and I recommend it. I recommend it to everyone, and I don't think that having these types of handicaps and other kinds, for that matter, should make people there think they're not possibly competent parents. I think everyone has their difficulties, and if you can bring up your children with some honesty about that, and that people are not as depicted in the glossy magazines, and are in fact very complicated and often, almost always flawed, I think you can bring up children who are able to face their own lives.
Sure. Well, and I suppose, I mean, if I'm sure this impacted family life in many ways. I mean, you probably couldn't, assuming your children were musicians, it was probably difficult, if not impossible, for you to attend most or many of their functions, for instance. But for them to have to come to grips with that and understand your own weaknesses or the difficulties with which you were contending,
right,
that's probably
right.
Good for any young person to be sort of wrenched out of their own desires and think about someone else and their struggles, even if it's your own father.
Right. You've spoken truthfully. I mean, obviously there's that tug of war between difficulties I have and the needs of others, and tug of war between a sense that this is a character flaw and something more, like a medical disability. And, that's just the way it is.
The book again is called Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. It's published by Viking, and a fascinating book, start to finish. And its author, Alan Shawn. Alan Shawn, I'm so glad that you have written this book, and I'm sure it will be of tremendous help to anyone who lives with this reality, and I think will be tremendously interesting even to those who thankfully are not living with this sort of reality in their lives. We all have a lot to learn from your very interesting story, and I thank you today for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your interesting book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg, and to you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be spending a few minutes with Doug Instanis, Artistic Managing Director of the Racine Theatre Guild. They are about to reopen their doors to the general public for their very first public production since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. And it is a very, very fun show indeed. A Christmas Story, an adaptation of the beloved Christmas film. And we'll talk with Doug Instanis tomorrow about what it's felt like for the Racine Theatre Guild to be back in business. This weekend in the podcast versions of The Morning Show, a couple of very interesting interviews from the archives. From way back in 2005, David Marcus's marvelous book called What It Takes to Pull Me Through, Four Troubled Teenagers and 14 Months That Transformed Them. And on Sunday's podcast, Scandals, Vandals, and Da Vinci's, a gallery of remarkable art tales. Next week on The Morning Show, a number of different broadcasts, including Monday, my conversation recorded with Jay Tunney, one of the sons of Gene Tunney, one of the greatest heavyweight boxing champions in history. and also a remarkably intelligent and articulate man, very, very cultured. And the book focuses in particular on Jean Tunney's friendship with George Bernard Shaw. This remarkable book is called The Prize Fighter and the Playwright, Jean Tunney and George Bernard Shaw. You'll hear that interview on Monday. The morning show airs every weekday morning.